This podcast has ended and is no longer being updated. The company, Yizzy Research, no longer exists, nor does the coaching program or website. Please disregard any mention of these. You're listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, hosted and created by me, Imani, a researcher. This is the podcast for people who research people. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Nia Jarrett.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nia, a UX researcher through a communications background. I have my degree in public relations. After that, I entered education, became a certified teacher. I went back to public relations. And the pandemic, like for most of us, it was just a profound moment in my life. And so that led me to transitioning into UX, specifically UX research.
Nia will be talking about what she's learned in her years of being a UX research contractor. And your earlier career was in education and communications. How did you know that it was time to leave that structure and become a UX research consultant?
So one way for me to know that it was time for me to leave the structure was just when I graduated from college, I really didn't understand the profound importance of networking. And so coming out of college with a public relations degree and not really understanding the significance of that, I did struggle finding a job, which is how I ended up in education. And so with that, I did well in that space for a couple of years, but just really reflecting on the responsibilities I had as a teacher and the responsibilities that is given to a teacher is not equal to the amount of pay or stress that we receive. And so I knew it was time for me to leave. And so that happened, thankfully, before the pandemic. So I was able to get back into public relations prior to that. But because the pandemic happened, I had to again pivot. And that's how I ended up in UX research through a boot camp through General Assembly. So that's how my journey ended up here.
And you mentioned something that was really important. When you graduated from undergrad, you shared that you didn't understand what the importance of networking was. And I think a lot of people can agree with that. Even when you're well into your career, networking still is an art and a skill. It's really hard. It can be hard meeting people. It can be hard pitching yourself. I know for a lot of people, it's hard to sell yourself. It can feel weird. How did you get comfortable networking?
Sure. So I got comfortable networking with realizing that I'm going to need community to help me to get where I'm going. I can't do this on my own. And everything that I have done up to this point is what I could do alone. And so I needed to rely on the help of others to get me to where I need to go. But to do that, I had to be vulnerable. So I had to completely get out of my comfort zone. So me doing such a significant career change at the beginning of the pandemic, like that was the start of my journey of living uncomfortably for a greater purpose. That's where all of that started.
I think the pandemic really upended life for all of us, especially our careers. I think a lot of people made pivots in their careers because of the pandemic. You had that time to reflect, and people weren't always happy with what they were doing. Like you mentioned, you were a teacher, and I've heard this story from so many teachers across the US that you're being paid, what you're being paid is not appropriate for what you have to deal with from the students, administration, from parents. It's a lot. And you're like, I want to move on and do something different. And so you were able to pivot into UX research by using the General Assembly bootcamp. And what about your career in communications? Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
So in communications, I had an internship in college with the Alumni Relations Department. And then once I left teaching, I was a volunteer public relations intern for a nonprofit. And networking with a public relations organization based in Houston, I was actually able to get a contract role for an international oil and gas company. So that was the last public relations role I had prior to getting into the boot camp for UX.
How do you think working in public relations has helped you as a researcher? I feel like there are probably some transferable skills there.
Yes. First off, stakeholder management, understanding how to navigate the different emotions people have in meetings. That's very important. Tone and delivery of information, whether it's verbally or through written communication. I've definitely transferred that skill over as well. The importance of listening versus speaking. Sometimes you just need to listen and just absorb the information before you're responding. Sometimes you don't need to respond at all. Sometimes you're just there just to gain some more insight into whatever's going on.
How did you secure your first UX research client? Because you were coming from a space that is not traditional UX affiliated, right? Like public relations, education, working as a teacher. So how did you make that jump? How did you get your first client?
I started out right after boot camp doing like a lot of informational interviews to just get to know more of the nitty gritty of like the day-to-day life of UX researchers. And I found it really different, you know, based on the work culture. So I found that out. And so also in those sessions, I learned about different online communities I could look at. For me specifically, it was most beneficial to learn about Slack communities. So through these different Slack workspaces that I was joining the job channels or the freelance channels or volunteer channels and learning about opportunities where they were looking for someone entry level, you know, because they didn't have a lot of budget or they just needed an assistant, something like that. And so that is where I was able to find my first projects, because as most people know, when you're fresh out of something, whether it's a degree program or a boot camp, the most often excuse you hear about not being hired is you don't have enough experience. Well, how can you get it if no one will give you the opportunity? So that's kind of how I found my opportunities, so I could build my portfolio to be a little bit stronger. So it wasn't just projects I had from my boot camp.
Yes, plus one to the Slacks. I think when I first started working for myself, that's how I found my first few contracts, I think, was through a variety of Slacks. And there are so many of them. Yes. And there are always different jobs, contracts posted that aren't posted elsewhere. Like I found things on different Slacks I couldn't find on LinkedIn or Indeed or Simply Hired. So I think that the Slacks are a great resource when you're getting started. You were using these Slacks to find clients.
Yes.
How does this differ from how you currently find clients?
I would say now that I have a stronger network, people can vouch for me personally. So sometimes I'm getting emails directly from someone who's working at the company or someone who has seen something maybe on LinkedIn or Indeed, and they're like, hey, I think you should apply. You're really good for it. So overall, I'm less talking to strangers through the Slack communities and more so talking to my connections that I have already built, who are leading me to job positions where I have a higher chance of going through the application process.
Yeah, I've heard hiring people say that they're more likely to interview someone directly if they're referred. So yes, that tracks. Do you remember some of the earlier challenges you had when you first began consulting?
Yes, earlier challenges, one of them was really deciding like, how do I want to price myself? Do I want to price myself based on the deliverable or do I want to price myself by the hour? That was one challenge I had. Another challenge was just the confidence of, can I actually do this? You know, whether it was volunteer or paid. And then when I did want to transition to just doing paid projects, do I feel quote unquote like worthy enough to be paid for my skills, even though I just finished this boot camp? And the answer is yes. Even if you're new, you still deserve to be paid because you took the time and effort to learn a completely different skill set that is still very important to the world.
Yeah, and pricing yourself is awkward at every level because who knows, which is why I really like using things like Glassdoor to at least give you a feel for what's out there. How do the earlier challenges you face in your UX research career compare to the current challenges you face?
I would say the earlier challenges were more of like an internal conflict, because you're new in the totally different career space. Now, the challenge for me is, what's the challenge for me now? Pushing myself to do the projects that are a little bit longer, maybe require more interaction with, you know, I don't want to say difficult clients, but clients that maybe need a little bit more attention. I mean, our stakeholders that need a little bit more attention. Earlier on, it was internal conflict of like whether I'm good enough to do this in this career, blase, blase. Now it's leadership skills. What leadership skills am I working on so that I can continue to advance myself based on the goals that I have long term for this career? Are these projects that I'm interested in alignment to my long term goals? Am I asking the right questions to my manager and my coworkers in relation to what I need to improve on in terms of my skill set in order to reach these long-term goals?
I want to revisit what you mentioned about pricing yourself. How do you know that the fee that you set is the right fee for your prospective client?
It was on, I think, like social media, but basically they were like, if you gave a number and a client immediately was like, yes, that means it's too low. it's too low if a client immediately like agrees to your price. So that's one thing I've heard. And another thing I've heard, it just like even in general, even like when you're stating like your salary on like a full-time job application, like if the number makes you uncomfortable, you know, that might be a little bit closer to the ballpark of where you should be. And if you totally have no idea, just like you mentioned, definitely do your research. So in case the stakeholder does have pushback as to like the number, you can kind of have some resources and say, hey, yo, this is where it came from, if they are interested.
Yeah. And also I would add to that, having a point at which you just walk away. I've had contract offers that I thought to myself, this is bogus. I would never accept this. And I didn't. I had decided ahead of time that if I received below a certain number, I'm just not going to take it. So I think having a point at which you decide I'm going to walk away with your dignity and just moving on to something else is important as well.
I would definitely agree to that, especially once you get more projects under your belt and you start to have an understanding of how long it takes you to do certain things, especially research methods, you can start to look at the numbers and say, the math isn't mathing for this. It's a no for me.
Yeah, exactly. And then I want to also continue the conversation about vetting clients. So we talked about pricing. When vetting a prospective client, what are some clues that the client will not be a good fit for you?
Email communication. Sometimes you can tell just by how someone's communicating to you via email, and also like the frequency. So if they're emailing you 5 and 6 times and you're just in the proposal stage, we're just getting to know each other, you know, that might be concerning because they're communicating a lot. It might be over communication already, and that might continue on. It might be a sign of micromanagement as well, in terms of always needing to be informed about the next step of everything. What else do I look for? Email communication. Oh, I pay attention when it's like a virtual meeting and we're having our cameras on. Are they giving me most of their attention, or are they on the computer looking at whatever is on their computer monitor? I had an interview for a contract role that I found through Upwork once, and the guy that was interviewing me, in the interview, he had my portfolio on one screen, so he was looking at that. But I could also tell he probably had another screen somewhere else too, because he wasn't really asking me questions at a cadence in which I was answering them. So I could tell his mind was preoccupied on something else. And so that was an indication for me of, okay, this probably isn't the best fit.
Or if they don't show up to an interview. I interviewed for a contract years ago when I was first getting started, and there were two people who were supposed to interview me. Only one showed up, and the person who showed up was mortified that the other person didn't show up, and he was so humiliated and was apologetic, and she just didn't come. That's happened before. I was offered the job. I didn't take it, of course. She was supposed to be the hiring manager. So I thought to myself, okay, well, if she didn't care to show up, I have to work with her. Yeah. Absolutely not. Another situation I had in terms of a potential red flag people should look out for. Many years ago, also when I was first getting started, maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, I found a really great opportunity with a company for a contract, and they were trying to send me work to actually do, just begin research without having a contract in place, without having accepted my request to have a higher wage, and without having a statement of work. So they wanted me to start working without having these things in place, these documents in place. So that's another red flag. If they're trying to get you to work and do work without having signed a contract, without having had an appropriate negotiation process for the rate, and without having a statement of work so you know what you're doing. So that was another one I had to say no to. So just some other red flags for people listening to watch out for.
Your time is important. You can't get your time back. So yes.
Exactly. And then, so conversely, what are some green flags for you? What are some things that you notice that make you say, oh, yes, this will be a great fit?
I would definitely say, once again, like body language, communication, like those let me know if it's a red or green flag for sure. I'm really into soft skills because just high emotional intelligence, you know, UX researchers. So I'm really into that. Green flags as well. When they can share the benefits that you can get as a contractor, specifically because in tech, for those of you listening, contractors usually have certain restrictions that full-time employees don't have. Like some things you might not be able to join if it's maybe like a annual party or annual meeting or all hands meeting. It just will depend company to company. And so for contractors, if you're going after a contractor role, specifically ask about the benefits for contractors, because usually they are different. And so that is what I look for as well. So for contractors, I want to know, like, what are the learning opportunities for contractors? I know they can't usually tell me, but what is it like? Like, how in the past, how many contractors have converted to full-time employee? Because that's not guaranteed, but it is a good idea to know in the past, you know, how often has that happened?
If you are an aspiring or current UX researcher who needs help with your resume, professional brand, interview skills, cover letter, LinkedIn profile, and portfolio, consider applying for the Yizzy Research Coaching Program. Coaching clients exit the program with a refreshed resume, cover letter, research portfolio, and detailed notes to make them more competitive in the UX research job market. If you are interested or know someone who is, visit yizzyresearch.com to learn more and apply. That's Yizzy Research, Y-Z-Z-I, research.com. I also think another green flag is good communication. So contracts that I have that I've enjoyed, the hiring person got back to me in a timely manner. They were very clear if there were delays, they would explain why the delay happened. Even if I didn't get a contract, they would explain to me why I didn't get it. That was a really good thing too, was just having great communication. So that's another green flag as well. And also just having people who you speak to and you just have a good conversation, it feels very natural. Yes. On the team you'll be working with, right? That's important. You're going to be with these people, not every day. You're going to be working with them on a regular basis. And if you have a good connection with them, it definitely helps make it easy to work with them. Yeah, communication and chemistry.
Yes, I would definitely say that. Just reflecting on like my most memorable interviews, they were the interviews where it evolved from the standard cookie cutter interview question and answer to, and just naturally, organically flowed into an actual conversation.
Yeah, those natural conversations are definitely the best when people start asking, what type of dog do you like? What countries have you traveled to? You get comfortable. Yeah, it does make you feel good. So let's say once you've secured a client, what documents do you need to have in place to enter a work relationship with them? So like a master level service agreement, a statement of work, NDAs, et cetera.
Thankfully, I have elevated to enterprise level clients through contracting companies. And so for the most part, they send me the documents. I don't necessarily have to send any on my own unless it's a more so like short-term freelance project. So I'll speak to more so the enterprise level. And so for that case, typically I'm doing an NDA. If it's a highly regulated company, I might have to do a background check. I'm sending in my verification of employment history. I am also doing work to be a W-4 employee for the contracting company if that is the setup of the work agreement with the enterprise client as well.
Now, let's say you've secured your client, you're on the job now, mm-hmm. You share your readout and deliverables with the client and they're not happy about it. What do you do?
So I let them know first off that, you know, I appreciate them, first of all, coming to the readout, because sometimes they don't come. Sometimes you just email it to them. So I do thank them for their time of actually coming to the readout, but also reiterating the fact that, yes, this may not be the ideal outcome that they wanted, but they have a starting place. There's no better option than just to improve if you're already not, what am I trying to say? There's only space to improve if the users are not happy. And so you have the greatest opportunity to just showcase that, one, you know how to listen to users, but two, you also know how to take that feedback and implement it in a way in which they interpreted it through their mental models.
Also, something I've learned over the years is to not be so attached to work in general, including how people will respond to things like your readouts, your deliverables. Just taking it with a grain of salt, because ultimately it's just a job, right? It's not your life. So I remind myself of that too, that it's not that deep, just to add some additional perspective and context too around that, about how I approach that as well, is just taking it for what it is. These are just people giving feedback. And so between contracts, I imagine that you have gaps sometimes. Yes. What do you do with those gaps in between contracts?
So I might do a passion project. I might increase my attendance in networking events, whether they're in person or virtual. And I might try to look for like short-term projects as well through like websites like Upwork.
What are some passion projects you've worked on?
Oh, sure. So my favorite one was a couple years ago when Spotify announced they were expanding their market to Africa and the Caribbean. And so because I am of Caribbean descent, I was like, okay, this sounds cool. Maybe I can do a project around it. And so I did a project around podcasts in those areas and like what type of podcast shows would be like relevant or important. And so I did the design through Figma community templates, and I did their UX research as well. So that was really, really fun.
That does sound fun. And what did you learn from doing that passion project?
Sure. So I learned that although I'm not that confident in design, I can still do it if I really, really need to. So that was nice, even if it was, you know, with the template where I didn't have to create it from scratch. But also I learned that there's just a certain level of unintentional rigor you place on projects when you are genuinely passionate about the subject. Like, I didn't have to wake up and say, okay, Mia, it's time to work on the project. I was up and ready. What's the next step? How many interviews do I have today? Okay, later this week, I need to synthesize. How many hours should I put on my calendar to synthesize? I need to make a time to eat lunch, because if not, I'll keep on going throughout the day. So different things like that.
How do you represent your passion projects in your research portfolio?
By talking about how I initiate things on my own. That's a great example of that in my portfolio, and also showcasing my design skills because I am mainly a UX researcher. So that's another way in which I show my design skills as well. And how else do I represent it in my portfolio project? Just also another way of doing a project of based on real world events. This is like an outcome of learning about a real world event and what could be the response through UX, through a UX perspective.
I like that, using UX as a response to real world events. I like that perspective and how you worded that. I always say, like, yeah, UX research is problem solving or understanding a problem or a solution better. So I like how you worded that, though. For a lot of people, when they do passion projects and they talk about it in interviews, it could be awkward sometimes because some hiring people don't view those as real work.
Yes.
Even if you did real work. So how do you talk about your passion projects in interviews?
Well, I talk about it with as much passion as the other projects, so they can genuinely see and hear just the eagerness and joy I have about the project. So they know, like, okay, no, she's really into UX research, like, for sure, even in this passion project. So that's one way I talk about it. So although, you know, I am aware that they recognize it wasn't paid or it wasn't a real client, she still took the work seriously. So it's a testament to my work ethic as well. Even though I'm not being paid for that project, I still took it seriously and pretended that I had stakeholders to answer to at the end of the day in terms of having a really thought out insights that were the result of the research that I did.
Yeah, communicating that same passion. I always say experience is experience. I've spoken with people on the podcast and also just offline in real life beyond this. And many of them are academics or were academics. So they did a lot of academic research, which for me, that counts as real world experience, especially at the PhD level. But when they went to actually talk about that experience in job interviews, oftentimes it was discounted. I've also heard that about that with people who've done boot camps. Like, they had real experience, but it was discounted. So I think it's cool that you address your passion projects with the same passion that you would a project that was done in a more formal business context.
Yeah. And I would also say, for your examples that you just gave, for anyone that is experiencing that, lean also into your transferable skills if you feel like they're really not getting what you find important in terms of the accomplishments of the project.
Yeah, transferable skills are always good to highlight as well. And also making sure that you're using the same language and verbiage that's used in the industry that you want to do UX research in.
Yes. Yes.
Previously, you talked about what you did in the gaps between your UX research contracts, and that's when you focus on doing some kind of development. When you do, in working for yourself, how do you answer what's next?
Sometimes I just take the time to just reflect, like, what are projects that I've done in the past that really, really excited me? Do I want to extend those projects? In terms of upcoming events I want to go to, if I know the speakers, is there anything I might want to ask them about what they're, you know, getting involved in or what they're currently involved in, to maybe see, is there a way in which I can collaborate with what their responsibilities are at the moment. For short-term contracts, like on Upwork, in terms of what's next, I'm looking at the type of business that is looking for UX researchers, like, what exactly is their product or service, and am I interested in that, so that I actually can give the dedication that needs to be done for that job.
Do you want to do contracting indefinitely, or do you eventually want to have, like, a full-time job at a company?
That's a good question. That's a really great question. I would say just on the state of the world, I like UX job-wise, I would actually love to be converted to a full-time employee. I need some stability. I do like the contract work, but I really would like a little bit more stability in terms of getting full-time employee role.
Yeah, and those full-time roles, like you're alluding to, come with benefits, right? Like paid vacation, which you don't always have when you're a contractor. There are some contracts I had that did pay me for vacation, but most didn't. Insurance, again, some contracts that give me insurance, but some didn't. A 401k, you know, those types of perks that you can have when you are working for a company. When you're self-employed as opposed to when you're working full-time, they each have their pros and cons. Like you said, stability is a really big one of working for a company as opposed to working for yourself. You have more flexibility. So yeah, you have to find a balance between those two.
Yes, very much so.
And lastly, Nia, do you have any other tips for researchers who aspire to be research contractors?
One, there's a space for you, so don't give up. Two, don't forget you're not going to get where you're trying to go by yourself. Lean into your community. And a great way to do that is networking. And to do that, you need to build genuine connections. So what that means is don't try to connect with someone and then a couple like weeks later, then ask them for a job referral. Like those kind of relationships need to be strengthened and grow before you feel like it's okay for you to ask for help, but also make it mutual. So don't just reach out to them just for you to get a job. Also provide them feedback or celebrate any posts that they have done on LinkedIn or comment on a post that they've done on LinkedIn or any other social media job boards.
Thanks for listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, the podcast for people who research people. I'm Imani, the host and creator. Visit yizzyresearch.com for podcast show notes and information about my UX research coaching program. Again, that's yizzyresearch.com, Y-Z-Z-I, research.com. This podcast was produced by Whisper and Mutter.